Program of the Foundation for Iranian Studies, interview with Mr. Mansour Farhang, interviewer Mahmoud Khami, 21 October 1989, New York.
What I was saying was we did not see any danger in the religiosity of the people we were working with politically because of our previous experience of coexisting and working together. For me, for example, in the immediate post-coup period, as well as many pro-Mossadegh mullahs in Iran. And the second thing was that, again, the idea of an open political environment being established in Iran was perceived as a real possibility.
At this time, around the early 60s, you were aware of
Khomeini's activities? Only to the extent that we read about it in the papers and all that. I knew about his activities. He wasn't all that active, first of all. You see, when, that's also, it's this huge exaggeration about his activities after he left Iran. You know, he was sitting in Najaf, and people used to come and go. There was really no systematic organization of any kind. Again, in the tradition of where people go visit him, and he always has words of encouragement and all that for all these people. I knew more about his activities because later on, Yazdi, who was a student here, he was doing his graduate work at MIT in chemistry. He is a genuine religious, you know, person. Again, in the tradition of respecting pluralism, which was very familiar to us
absolutely.
When the first time we were moving here, the first time we came to New York, we had something to do. I urged him, I said, when we're going to get all these Iranians together, the first thing I really want you to say is that it is not required for Iranian women here to wear Rusari and all. And he did that, and there were a number of occasions. And all. Gradually, in the position of power and the impediments in the way and all that, they all went through change. You know, they all went through change because they were faced with a different kind of reality. Anyway, Yazdi was Khomeini's representative in the United States only for one principal reason, that there were many merchants and religious people in Iran who wanted to give money to Khomeini, Sahm Imam, and they didn't want to do it directly for security reasons. They sent the money either through Europe or the United States to Khomeini's representatives, and then they sent the money to Khomeini, but it was. Yazdi played that role, and he was also a very serious, you know, political activist and person. He had traveled there. He had met Khomeini earlier. Khomeini knew him personally and on two different occasions until he actually quit his job when Khomeini was about to be expelled from Iraq and went to Najaf. But also knew him through Yazdi. And again, you know, the political activities of these people were not really all that extensive as political. They were far more important for many years in cultural, religious, and organizational terms, and in strictly political terms.
How about Chamron? What kind of attitude?
In August 1962, when Zahedi was accused of refusing visa to Qutzadeh, and we went to San Francisco and staged a demonstration in front of the consulate. It's still on the front page of San Francisco Chronicle because they were not used to demonstrations yet. Mm-hmm. 2 years later, the situation changed with the free speech movement. In that demonstration, Mustafa Chamberlain and his American wife, who was pregnant, were demonstrating, and in the San Francisco Chronicle there is a reference that Iranians are so intense about this demonstration that they even bring their pregnant wives. He lived in Berkeley. Mostafa was a brilliant physicist and at the same time a very disturbed person from my point of view. I mean, I used to say the same thing, that he was very religious and yet scientific, and his obsession was to bring the two together, to prove that, you know, religious edicts and doctrines are completely scientific. And so that's why his closeness to Bazargan and Nakhshab and those people. And a very dedicated and, you know, by all general kind of conventional definition of a sincere human being, he was impeccable, you know. And exactly such people could also be very dangerous. But, you know, he had two children with the same wife, Mary. He quit his job in early 70s. I think it was 73. He quit his job. He was a professor of physics. Left his wife and children behind and went to Lebanon, you know, and joined the Palestinian group, and Imam Musa said, fundamentally became a teacher originally. He went there to teach physics, mathematics in general. And gradually got more and more involved in the politics and guerrilla activities of Imam Musa Saj, you know, and he had connection with Iran. Chamran was a bit, and I saw him in Iran, in fact, at my sister's house when I returned. We sat together and recollected our memories of the past. And he remained fundamentally a very calm, quiet, but incredibly intense person for whom everything ultimately had a religious justification or lacked a religious justification. A very mystical person.
And he was a follower of Khomeini from the beginning?
Khomeini really came on the scene very late. These people did not even believe in marja. Even if they did, it was a theoretical abstraction. They were not Bazargan, they were modernists. They were definitely in the mold of Islamic modernism. Attraction of Khomeini to even people like Chamran and Yazdi was purely political. It was purely political to Bazargan and the rest. Except that they did not see any threat. They saw a holy man, a religious man who is politically useful to them without being a threat or a competitor. This was the reality of the orientation toward whom. They were not followers, like, not at all. Chamran considered himself a mullah, you know, that he was the source of invitation himself. And he was a learned man, you know, within his own, you know, not Bazargan. When Bazargan, I tell you parenthetically, when Bazargan met Khomeini in Paris for the very first time, when he came out, they asked him, what do you think of him? He said, I saw a Shah with a turban on his head. Absolutely, in Paris. That's parenthetic, and it's way into the future. You know, and Khomeini, initially, I mean, Khomeini treated these people with an incredible amount of dignity and deference. Let me give you an example of how, not with Khomeini, but the similar kind of relationship between mullahs and religious modernists of Bazargan, Chamran, Yazdi. In 1955, 56, as a high school student in Iran Shahr, I used to go to Masjid Hidayat on Friday nights with a group of political people. There wasn't much of an activity, but still there were remnants, and it was kind of nostalgic. Begode and Taleghani is the preacher. He spoke every Friday night. Thursday night, that is, you know, by during the same period, Yazdi and Chamran were students in the university, and they had formed an organization, Anjumane Islami Mohandesin. Bazargan and Sahabi were the instigators, and Sapaghian, Yazdi, Chamran, Mu'infar, they were all students. They were the followers, given. And they used to come to Masjid Hidayat as a group. As a group. I remember so vividly, so distinctly, that they come in like 10 of them or 12 of them at once, all wearing tie and very neat like Bazargan. So when they walk into, first of all, Taleghani always knows they're coming, they don't come for prayer or anything like the rest of the, they come for the speech. When they come, the Taleghani always knows they're coming, because Taleghani, Taleghani was also a friend of my father. Not too close, but they used to get together, you know, once in a while with a couple other people, used to smoke opium together, you know. Whereas at the moment these people, 10, 12 people, enter the mosque, these mullahs who are sitting there, they were so elevated. That is, they get so much prestige and social acceptability from presence of university students and university professors in their domain, you know. And you could see it in their eyes. For all those years, and even until immediately after the revolution, the mullahs had a very high view of people like Bazargan and Sahabi and Yazdi and Chamran, both theoretically, theologically, as well as politically. But they thought they are much stronger with respect to the popular base that they turned out to be. In comparison with the kind of power that the mullahs developed immediately after the revolution. So the attitude of these people toward the mullahs, or perception of what they might or might not do in the position of influence, has to be seen in the context of what they had experienced in their long relationship with them. Retroactive kind of judgment is historically meaningless. So they were not only they were not afraid, but they acted with a great deal of dignity and authority, and not at all in any submissive, timid position at all.
But this was transformed later.
Completely. You see, we are talking about a period where people are involved in political struggle in the hope and expectation of accomplishing something, and often really deep down feeling frustrated and defeated. The way human beings operate in this kind of context is a very different story than when they are controlling the state and the state apparatus. All societies, all human, we all go through transformations and all that. It's a different, distinct, in a period. The past is important and all that, but it is not at all a replica of, or judging these people, what happened subsequently, too difficult, completely transformed.
Now, people like Wolf Bader and Chamran, Yazdi, and Banisar, were they interconnected in terms of their activities early on, or how was this?
They were competitors, and they could never work together as a group before or after the revolution, except that because there was no urgent need for them to form a unified group before the revolution, this divisiveness, jealousy, competitiveness, inability to get together, the way I view it, characteristics of Iranian political culture which were as inculcated in this group as any other in a group. They were all there, except that the destructiveness of this attitude was not pronounced, was not felt before that, because there was no, they were scattered enough. Otherwise, they made no attempt. They couldn't, in fact. The Bani Sa'd came to the States in 1974. Yazdi boycotted his speeches. He asked his friends and followers not to attend Bani Sa'd's. Bani Sa'd himself was very critical, kind of sarcastic about what Shariati was doing. He completely, you know, a person of monumental ego, with all kinds of other characteristics. I don't have any one-dimensional reductionist in the view of these people at all. They were very divided. When one thing that, and each was different. Each was, Yazdi was an organizer. He was a scientist and a brilliant student and a very bright man. Very self-centered and pragmatic in the American sense. Bozadeh was Dashakol Hidayat. I mean, for him, intellectualism was a waste of time. I don't think probably he ever read a book in his life. He was an agitator and an activist. You know, given a project to do a mischief, he's there. And in politics, obviously, these people are useful. Politics of every society at all times. That's the nature of the activist. Bani Sa'd is a complete anarchist who thinks he already knows the world and there is no reason for him to listen to anyone else. He has it all figured out. Completely opposed to organization. Totally. He develops a series of one-to-one connection and relationship, some of them very humane, very interesting, and very friendly, and all that. Someone else who was also in the same group, a completely different character, was Habibi, who is, you know, if he knows, if he is capable, he's an extremely powerful man in Iran today. He's really the chief of the staff today. He has as much power, I would say, in Iran, that more so than someone like Sununu in Washington. Okay, isn't that? But whether he can exercise, I don't know, whether he has that kind of talent. He was also in Paris. He was a man who could get along with anybody and everybody. And he had a kind of cordial and civilized relationship with all these people. So jealousy, pettiness, competitiveness, inability to work together, and other divisiveness characterized the political behavior of all these Hindu elements, which I could also say characterized the political behavior of the leftists. But it's fascinating that it did not, I mean, the group that the Muslim Student Association as a group was much more cohesive and enjoyed greater degree of solidarity than any other political group. And the reason they managed to remain cohesive and unified was because they were not really political until the very end.
And the regime didn't seem to consider them very much of a...
Not at all. I don't think... They used to go home and... Mohsen Nourbakhsh, who is the Minister of Economics and all that. He was an activist, I know him, you know, intimately at UC Davis, a very good student, a very studious, but a conservative. I could, you know, he invited me to his house without exaggeration a dozen times and I never went because I knew that we cannot connect socially. But I liked him politically. He was very civil, he was informed, he always exhibited respect for pluralism, and he could be, I could tell you, if Bazargan had remained prime minister, he would have been an important technocrat in the regime. If there was no revolution, he would have been a technocrat in the regime. He would not have moved up as fast. He would not have moved up as fast. But he would have, you know, the revolution made it. When he came to Iran, first he came to see Banisadr. There wasn't, first he went to see Minachi, who was Minister of Information. He didn't have anything for him. So he came to Banisadr, and Banisadr's office and all that was complete chaos. There was no power. There was only name and symbolism. You know. Beheshti got hold of him, and he was a completely malleable person, but nevertheless a committed religious person. So whatever objection someone like him might have to the regime, it is not in the realm of suppressing individual liberties in social culture choices. So many of the vast majority of the people who worked with Yazdi, they remained with the regime. Many people who were associates of Bazargan also. That's a different story, that how people made their choices when the time came to define themselves as opposition or join the crowd.
So first the confederation of Iranian students was confederate. How did the Muslim students relate to the confederation?
Totally rejected it. Muslim Students Association absolutely refused to engage in debates even. Not so much for ideological reason, because toward the end they were opening up, except that toward the end everything. Because they didn't want to be associated with radical political activists. They used to come to me and say, we are raising money to reprint Shariati's books. Do you know anybody, you know? I said, well, I know this or that, let's give him a call and say, this is the kind of activity, for example. We want to build a mosque. So they go and rent an apartment in Sacramento, as they did. Or they rent an apartment in Oakland, as they did. In Washington, we want to build a library in association with the mosque. So these are activities that engage people, except that they were always involved in doing something very concrete. They also contributed to each other's sense of cultural identity. In late 1960s, suddenly we see Iranian woman coming here wearing shirt. Let me give you an example. In 1960, when I first came here, in an average group of students, if somebody wanted to pray, he or she had to hide, you know, their ritual and go somewhere to do it. In late 60s, they were proud of doing it in front of others. Because their number has increased, so they no longer felt isolated, there was this religious upsurge in Iran, and there was a body of literature. That body of literature was extremely important as political the inculcation of political sensibilities, whether it is logical or illogical, that's parenthetically, the article Dariush Ashuri wrote about this before, I think it's childish. Anyway, but that's good.
This increase in the number of students with Islamic tendencies, what do you think
due to economic development in Iran and modernization, a new class of lower middle class people in land speculation, in import export, massive amount of money fused into the Iranian economy. I gave you the example of my own sister. They were very typical. That is, we have a class of newly rich, petty bourgeoisie who are sending their children to a school for the very first time to college. There is a fundamental difference between these people and the middle class. The traditional conventional middle class agreements. Let's say, for example, in the kind of middle class environment that I was raised and most of my friends, there was a kind of harmony, a kind of integration between material possibilities, the amount of money, income a family had, and the level of cultural sophistication, or cultural values, openness, and so forth. And it had developed over a long period of time, I would say probably over a period of 50 to 100 years, you know. Let's say the technocratic elements in Iran, the bureaucratic type, middle class, you know, merchants, and so forth. They were harmless. The newly rich, you know, petty bourgeoisie, in a very short period of time, their economic possibilities expanded dramatically. But culturally, they remained very traditional. It's impossible for culture orientation to go through drastic transformation and remain authentic. You know? But it's possible to win a lottery and become a millionaire overnight. And many of these people were exactly the same. So they felt they came to Berkeley because, you know, like many of us came here and had to work. Many of them never worked. So economically, they were far better off than the students who preceded them as a group, you know. But culturally, they had the kind of attachments that hardly existed in the earlier generation of Iranians coming up. A large number came from small towns, from Azerbaijan, from Isfahan, from Yazd, you know. You don't find too many students, that the disproportionate number of students came from middle-class families of Tehran, you know, for all the families of, but not in beginning in late 60s due to, in fact, economic success, you know, produced a kind of alienation that demanded, on the one hand, the desire for attachment to the old, at the same time, demand for political participation, you know, now that, you know, that so much has been written about it, but they were different in that sense.